we're struggling, I believe, for our very survival as a country and as a culture. I see it as nothing short of that.
Coming up on British Thought Leaders, Peter Whittle, founder and director of New Culture Forum. Peter says the essence of what it means to be British is under attack.
There is a sense in which the broader culture as well, our very sense actually of what we are as people, where we come from, but also just even biologically, is being shaken, is being made to be uncertain. People no longer know, they can't be certain about anything. And I think a lot of that's been quite deliberate.
He says more people are waking up to the cultural damage.
If you constantly are told that you're wrong to feel that, you're wrong to be concerned about migration, you're wrong to sort of somehow think that there's two sexes, you're wrong to be patriotic, all of these things, it's implied every day in our culture, in an odd way. From the moment you wake up, a criticism of these, of those feelings, is sort of implied all the way along. And basically people, that's what after a while makes people so angry, they want to burst. You know?
Welcome to British Thought Leaders, I'm Lee Hall. Today I'm delighted to be joined by Peter Whittle, founder and director of New Culture Forum. Peter, thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure, Lee.
You founded New Culture Forum back in 2006.
That's right. Coming up to 20 years, yes.
Only 20 years. So you, at the time, you must have seen on the horizon some problems for British culture.
Well, yes, thank you for pointing that out, because what's happened really is that when we started the NCF, it was very much a case of the argument being economic.
Right.
And most people were just obsessing about that. But it seemed to me that the things that were changing the country and which preoccupied me the most were cultural things. At that time, particularly, it was a growing sense that free speech was constricting. Even then, long before wokery and all of this stuff and hate speech. And then also there was the thing with radical Islam. We just had 9/11. That was very much in the, you know, memory then. And then we also had, 7/7 here. And so it was in that context. And I remember I had come back from, I'd been in America for 5 years. And I came back and I really did not like the changes I was seeing in Britain. And, you know, you see it with fresh eyes. And so really, I thought, well, we've got to start something up. I was working at the time in the media, in television, and that's where this sort of sense of groupthink became very apparent to me. You know, it had always been there, but I think it had intensified. And, the NCF was really a response to that, actually.
Oh, did you expect things to kind of get as bad as they have?
That's a very good question. Yes, basically. I think things are happening, or should I say no? Things are happening now that you couldn't have imagined. So that we've got political leaders who can't define what a woman is, things like that, which you would have thought was just utterly peripheral, kind of crazy stuff back then, and not anymore. In terms of Brexit as well, for example, interestingly, which I always saw as a kind of cultural thing too, actually, far more than economic, which is one of the reasons why the Remain campaign was such a flop. They could never see that. But in fact, you know, back in 2006, people would still have thought your head case if you said we should come out the EU or we will come out the EU. That was still a peripheral viewpoint, can you believe, even then. And so, yes, I think, that one wouldn't have foreseen. And also just the levels of migration, which, you know, are so incredible now. And back then, people would have said, no, you're just scaremongering. And people used to say you were scaremongering if you talked about, 150,000 people. Right. And the way it's changed Britain is so extraordinary, and in such a small space of time, you know.
You've got your new book out.
Yes.
It's called State of Emergency.
Yes.
Quite a stark and urgent title.
It is, really.
Can you tell us a bit about the
yes.
book?
Yes. Well, we've done three, see. We did one called The Long March, which was all about basically the idea of the Long March through the institutions, yeah. how it happened, how kind of deliberate was it, you know, how far were the Tories to blame by never ever sort of understanding it. There was that. Then Fighting Back, which was a response really to that. And this one, it goes a little bit further and it sort of sets out what our 10 points for what really should happen in order to try to save Britain, actually, save British culture. And it's 10 pledges which we will be putting to candidates whenever the next election is, you know, whether it's in May or whether it's in November. But basically, underneath that, we have a series of essays which basically explain why we've come to those conclusions. State of emergency, yes, because I think it is in a state of emergency. We have been for quite a while. And I think there was a point last year, I remember, where I felt, and others that I spoke to felt, that you had a palpable sense of the ground giving way underneath you. You know, I mean, that does sound very alarmist, but it was a very sincere perception, you know, on my part. I thought, this is getting serious now. I mean, you know, basically, there was a sort of sense in which the environment in which we live was actually becoming so decayed that, in fact, decline was palpable now on a daily basis. So I think that is a state of emergency. And I think the source of frustration is that I don't believe that the main parties, or should we say the Conservative Party, I'm not too worried about what Labour thinks, you know, but Conservative Party doesn't just appreciate this, doesn't quite understand it, even now. As a result, you know, we hope that they will agree with what we feel are the things that need to be done, actually.
Probably the biggest issue of our time is immigration. We had William Clouston here recently. He talked about a generational pause,
yes.
30 years of no immigration. Would you agree that that's the way to go?
Yes, I think that the SDP actually have got the only genuinely radical policy about migration, actually. And it's interesting that it's now an idea, that one you mentioned, which is quite possible to have. Everyone can see William is a very reasonable man, and they can see that the SDP are not sort of, right-wing head bangers or whatever. Therefore, I found that quite interesting that it is now, the situation has moved on so that it's now not so outrageous to even suggest something like that. I myself have suggested a very similar thing, a moratorium on immigration. The fact is that, you know, there are two ways of looking at it. Demographically, if the situation goes on like it is now, then white British people will be a minority in their own country within, easily under 40 years, I think. Again, that was something that if you'd said that 50 years ago, people would just simply have thought you were a fantasist. But then on top of that as well, just purely on a practical level, you know, if you want to get a grip on this issue, then basically you're never going to do that while you've still got 700, 600, however many it is, 1,000 net coming in every year. I mean, basically, you've got to be able to have a breather, you know, and basically get your house in order, put a new system in place and all of that. That requires time. I mean, I think William was saying something like a generation, 20, 25 years. That seems reasonable to me. But I think that That is what reform should put forward. Reform, certainly, I think you've had reform people.
Yeah, yeah, you? About 3%.
Well, you know, reform have got a immigration. I've just myself interviewed Richard Tice. He's got an immigration policy, which is a little bit convoluted, actually. But it amounts to one in, one out. And I don't think that is satisfactory at all. And I think that they should go for, you know, a complete halt to mass migration. And essentially, they would probably see their support go even further up. I mean, the reason I mentioned reform is that they are essentially, are they not, sort of the one small party that's making headway?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. On this topic of politics, I mean, a lot of people are feeling politically homeless now, yeah, and not really clicking with any of the major parties. Yes. But it's a massive year, not just for the UK, but for the US as well. Yes. What are your thoughts and hopes for the coming year? Are you feeling politically optimistic?
Well, something's got to change. And I do think that optimism seems like a surreal emotion at the moment. But I think that there is a certain cautious excitement I have, in the sense that whether it's before the election or perhaps afterwards, something is definitely going to happen in British politics. It can't go on like this. What I would like to see, I'm afraid, I don't know how allied you are or not to the Conservative Party, but would be for it to be virtually wiped out and a new proper Conservative Party. It is possible for it to happen. We've got this terrible electoral system, I know that, but given that we have, that is one of the few options that we would have to look forward to, which is that basically a new party could emerge. Now, that might only happen after we've had the election. But one way or another, and also, even if that doesn't happen, we also know something, which might also be kind of rather depressing. And that is that, what, are we just going to kind of go on, just slowly declining down this road? That's why I think it's got to be something drastic that happens. For example, if the Tory party just about made it back, or just, you know, if it was just not an absolutely terrible defeat, that's almost a worse situation, I would say. But then you also need a new party, or one of these smaller parties, that basically got to be genuinely courageous and genuinely radical and treat the situation with the kind of urgency that it obviously requires. You know, I get very fed up with Westminster politics. I mean, here we are in the heart of Westminster, and I'm based in Westminster too. The way in which it's all about who's in, who's out, and the ups and downs of politics. And I can't get interested. It seems so beside the point now, because we're struggling, I believe, for our very survival as a country and as a culture. I see it as nothing short of that. And so therefore, we have to play the game politically. You know, you have to sort of, you know, play the party political game. So I would say that this year will be the first year for some time that we will have some form of an answer. Maybe there'll be something new, or perhaps there won't be. But, you know, we will then know, for better or worse.
Going to be a big year.
Yeah.
Now, I wanted to talk a bit about culture. If we look at Japan, and it's proudly guarded its culture for millennia and done quite a good job of that.
Yes.
But if we look at Britain, it's almost like being proud of our heritage is frowned upon and looked at as bigoted and things along those lines. I mean, how do we get to that point and what can we do about it?
It's would be like turning round a tanker. Mm. I think the difference really is that in the past there was this sort of view, oh, the British, they hide their light under a bushel, they're always doing themselves down. It was a kind of romantic view, you know, and it was sort of one that was almost, I'd say, based on the form of superior knowledge anyway, you know, it was, complacency. But I think that there is no space anymore for that kind of excuse, because we're not, it's not just a case of we're doing ourselves down. I mean, I think that there's a complete difference between self-mocking humour and annihilation. And that's what we are facing really at the moment. And I think all aspects of our culture are seriously under attack, mostly from within. Our institutions, our cultural institutions, no longer believe in what they are, what they do or what they're meant to do. They want to decolonize their collections. British Library, British Museum, whatever. The whole modus operandi is one of defensiveness, or not actually actual shame. Shame about what the collections say. British arts are broadly being, you know, derided or in some ways, downgraded. There is a sense in which the broader culture as well, our very sense actually of what we are as people, where we come from, but also just even biologically, is being shaken, is being made to be uncertain. People no longer know, they can't be certain about anything. And I think a lot of that's been quite deliberate, you know, and I think a lot of it comes from an internal kind of infiltration that's come through the institutions, something which I wish the Conservative Party would understand more. They've always just left it alone and never done anything about it. Education, of course, is the very, the most vital part of this attack. You know, what kids are being taught now, what they're not being taught, that is a great worry for the future. They no longer know. They don't know what they're meant to be defending. They don't know what is meant to be so good about our society. So they now walk around thinking there's actually nothing good about our society. And anyway, what is British culture anyway? You hear that all the time. What is British culture? Well, it's very easy. You know, you can go through it historically if you like, or you can go through the various qualities, or you can go to all the various achievements, whatever it is. But they're not equipped with that anymore. So basically, they don't really think that there is anything worth defending. I mean, I think that this, well, obviously, the name, the New Culture Forum, tends to suggest that these are the most important aspects of the problem that we face at the moment. And of course, to go back to immigration, it's allied to that. Yeah. You know, it's allied to that because there is so much sort of shame or dislike for the indigenous culture that sort of there is also somehow just an uncritical attitude to any other culture, you know, that any other culture is automatically more interesting, it's more, you know, it's enriching and all of these things. It's not necessarily the case.
The British character is to be kind of accepting and polite of, you know, things that go wrong or difficulties or hardships. But it seems when it comes to these culture wars, it's maybe not the best approach to take. I know you're out in your branches now with New Culture Forum.
Yes.
You're meeting people in Britain.
Yeah.
Are you finding British people are waking up and they want to do something?
I think, oh yes, I think people, just been having this very discussion before I came here today, people are joining up the dots of things.
Right.
So they don't see so much this an issue here and an issue there. And they can see much more, you know, how things are, you know, joined up. So, for example, you've got the government's, the establishment reaction to COVID, for example, a few years ago. And we've now got this seeming incapability to do anything about migration. So people say, wait a minute, 2 or 3 years ago, you managed to absolutely upend society very effectively and very quickly. So you can do things when you really want. So why can't you do something about this, you know? And so I think that there is a kind of extraordinary anger now amongst people, and rage, in fact. But a lot of it is born as well of being told for so long that they are wrong to feel that. You know, that there are two things there. On the one hand, they have rage about what's happening to our country. But then on the other hand, if you constantly are told that you're wrong to feel that, you're wrong to be concerned about migration, you're wrong to sort of somehow think that there's two sexes, you're wrong to be patriotic, all of these things, it's implied every day in our culture, in an odd way, from the moment you wake up, a criticism of these, of those feelings is sort of implied all the way along. And basically people, that's what after a while makes people so angry, they want to burst, you know. So we have started branches. Also because I want more of a movement than... we started as a think tank. We publish things. We have our very successful channel. But basically, much more of a movement. People out there think that somehow they're going crazy, you know, that they're going insane when they are faced with the day-to-day news as they see it, what's happening. We have to say, you know, you really are not, you know, you're not going crazy. Indeed, you're in the majority. And basically, you've got to make association with other people who feel like that. And so, you know, we started 10 now we've got. By the end of this year, we'll have many more than that. But honestly, the response has been extraordinary, you know, and incredibly more humbling for me, actually. You know, because people come along, 40, 50 people on a wet Tuesday evening. Anyone who's been involved in party politics will know that's really good going. Of course, we use our channel to publicise things. Yeah. And so, you know, it's essentially, yes, and we have a national conference to which all the people come. And so I suppose that is much more of a movement than just a Westminster organisation. I'm much more interested in, or hopefully giving a voice to people out there than hobnobbing with the Under Secretary of State for I don't know what, you know what I mean, yeah. In some Westminster pub.
It was almost a thing that was lost a bit in the pandemic. Everyone was siloed, but to actually meet up and,
yes,
and discuss things and plan things,
yes,
it's,
yeah,
great that you're bringing it back, I think.
No, I think it's incredibly important. And, you know, it's some of these things sound so stale, you know, when you talk about the Westminster bubble, but it really is there. It really does exist. And, you know, I include the media in that. And I'm always very touched, I have to say. I mean, when you go to places that are, you know, going through a rough time, I was in Hull recently, for example. And I think if people bother to kind of come out and to meet like-minded people and to get involved, you know, frankly, when everything around them is, you know, is bleak maybe and is going through a bad time, then I find that just heroic, actually, on a kind of local level. And so I want to see much, much more of it, you know.
Yeah. So looking at London, I mean, you were born in London, you, yeah, were here for most of your life.
Yes.
But London's changed drastically in the last few decades. Oh, yeah, yes. Do you think the London that we know is lost? Can we get it back?
Yes. Are you for a Londoner, are you? Or?
No, I was originally from the Midlands, but I'm in London now.
Oh,
yeah.
Yes, I made a programme all about this very thing on the channel. We do a documentary series called Heresies, and I did one last September on London, why I'd left London. That was just the frame for it, really. But it must have touched a nerve. It's got like 750,000 views. It's extraordinary. But in answer to your question, is yes, I think it's just totally undeniable. It's not just Sadiq Khan. You know, it's really not. He's the current incarnation. No, the transformation of London has happened over a longer period than that, but then a very short period. My parents are from were South London working class people from Peckham, moved out to the suburbs, their type of Londoner, and that I include myself in that, is pretty much extinct now, you know. And I think, you saw Sadiq Khan recently do an ad where he's saying, everyone is a Londoner, no matter where you're from, and however long you've been here, man. I always find it very amusing when people do that. I mean, you wouldn't go to sort of Paris and sort of, if you lived in Paris for 4 years, I ask you, I mean, would you immediately call yourself a Parisian? I don't think I would. I mean, it would almost sort of be slightly, well, self-deluding, but also arrogant in a way. But this kind of way in which this essence of London has now been changed from having been a city that was organically the capital city of this country with its very particular traditions and that have grown over 1,000, 2,000 years. What has happened to it now is that it's just become a kind of place that you can belong to if you sign up to a whole set of, I would say, what, liberal values. You know, London never was, cities don't have values any more than companies have values. But we hear all the time about, you know, London's values. You know, it's always a sign that there's been capture, political capture, if someone starts talking about values. But in London now, you sort of, it does feel very much that kind of a woke, liberal mindset is the dominant one. And then demographically, of course, it's now a minority white British. I think since 1991, I think, it was something like 87%. It was still, you know, now it's right down to 37% in the last census. It's quite extraordinary, incredible change. But somehow one's not meant to comment on this. You know, it's almost, you're sort of, to actually draw attention to it is considered to be bad form, sort of, so what? Well, yes, of course, millions of people would have something to say about that. I mean, I don't like the tone of the city very much anymore either. It's just much more money orientated than it ever used to be. I grew up here and it's part of my character, actually, you know. But I moved out 2 years ago. I still am here for work. But I find that I don't really miss it. I, in fact, don't miss it anything like as much as I thought I would.
It's sad to think that something like the Cockney could become a kind of almost an extinct part of our society.
There aren't any anymore. Yeah. I mean, you know, EastEnders, the programme, it's a polite fiction. I mean, EastEnders, when was the last time that the East End that it portrays, when was the last time that that was a reality? Probably the 1980s, I think. The thing is, for just like a country, a city kind of develops and grows through a kind of, you know, set of traditions and communal experiences, you know, and nuances and all of those things. They just simply just disappear. I mean, if the population is no longer there. And that's exactly what's happened, really. I think it's terribly, terribly sad. But at the same time, it's just the way it is now. And I think our cities generally, not just London, but Manchester and Liverpool and Leeds, they are all transforming in to different degrees. I think it's actually regrettable. Causes me a certain amount of sadness.
Though in the past you worked in the media, you were on the South Bank show, yep. You've made many documentaries, interview shows, etc. Yes. I wanted to get your thoughts on the mainstream media, really, and its portrayal of British culture. Do you feel it's fair and balanced?
I think I don't really watch anything anymore, Lee, because I stopped paying the licence fee, I think it was 2020. the last thing I really watched. I remember it was the late Queen's COVID message. That would have been April 2020, something like that. And I watched that. And I don't know why that happened to be the last thing, but it was. I watched streaming services and things. When I have seen things, because I've been at friends with friends and things, it's so predictable. British drama, casting decisions that are made, we all know, you know, basically the subjects that are chosen, all of this, entirely within a political, ideological framework now. And you know it's coming, and you can sort of either decide to live with it or just not. And just, so I no longer watch the stuff, you know. It goes through most of the media. The reason I'm talking about the BBC is because, of course, we pay for it. That's the big difference. You know, so otherwise, people say, well, you don't have to watch it. Well, that's right. But therefore, you shouldn't have to pay for it either. I mean, I grew up watching BBC and everything about it, and I don't mind admitting. I mean, it does inform the very way you look at the world. But I'm talking about the 60s and 70s, a very strong sense of a communal viewing. That's gone anyway because of technology. But I think, you know, whether it's, in particular with the BBC, any form of historical drama, you know that you're going to retrospectively be taught lessons. You're going to have to look at very implausible situations and casting and sort of think to yourself, well, I know that I'm being sort of like, you know, challenged here to say or feel something, and I just won't rise to it anymore.
Yeah, and my vision of history is being changed.
Yes, exactly. Or yes, exactly, a black Anne Boleyn or... you know what's being done. You know, it's just basically, you know, well, so what? You know, that's what it's, well, so what? Well, of course, there's a big so what there. You know, it's just, there's no, I find it interesting with these sort of people who particularly make historical adaptations and history, they make huge fuss about how authentic everything is. And then they will have a huge multicultural crowd there in the sort of middle 16th century Glasgow or something, you know, or Edinburgh. It just simply wouldn't have been. So that's kind of, it's just boring. But I think that, interestingly, I think it does put people off as well. They won't necessarily say that's a reason, but I think it is one of the reasons. And, you know, when you think of all the things that you will never see treated in drama, I mean, and it's never going to happen now, so you will never get a drama or a series on mainstream media which, for example, has the changes wrought by immigration as one of its sort of background subjects. You know, you will only ever get it shown in a totally beneficial light. Similarly with climate change. Actually, with going back to Brexit, it would even have been with Brexit too. Almost any kind of viewpoint that you or I might think, well, that's a very reasonable point of view. That's one that many people, or even most people, have. You will not see in television programs. You won't see it written about in novels. You won't see a painting exhibition done along those lines. No one will go near Islam, but quite happily go into Christianity and disrupt it. After a while, you know, this is not new. This has been going on now for a long time, and it's very predictable, and it lessens the power of, you know, what was once, you know, one of our great assets, you know, with these sort of things. Same with the theatre. You know, you just, why go and see political drama in the theatre? You know, the most provocative thing a playwright could do now would be to make a play in which there was a positive case for Donald Trump, made an appearance, or a character was given, you know, something which showed Trump, you know, in a kind of favourable light, a speech maybe of some sort. And can you imagine? It's just inconceivable. It's inconceivable. And so after all, you just think, well, actually, I've never been there, done that, you know. What's the point of going and seeing the same old thing?
We're seeing the rise now of alternative media. You know, obviously, you're producing great stuff at New Culture Forum, but there's like Lotus Eaters, Trigonometry. Do you feel optimistic that these media can provide some kind of balance and redress?
I do, actually. I mean, I give thanks for it, actually. You've got to look at what they've done in America with alternative media, which is no longer... You can't even really call it alternative media anymore because it's so big. I mean, you know, the Daily Wire, for example, which is a channel I always admired, and it's, you know, had an amazing amount of investment. It now makes movies. It makes children's programs. Extraordinary. And that's just one. But one of the reasons it happens in America is because the market is huge. They also do still have a culture war in the sense that we've had a rout, and also they have more money. So there's much more potential for investment. But even having said that, I'm still very, very pleased with how things have expanded. I mean, I remember, 20 years ago, I got involved with this channel, which was run then by Tim Montgomery and Ian Dale, and it was called 18 Doughty Street. And it was basically an internet TV channel. But of course, that's before YouTube had not happened then. You tend to forget this. So of course, we sort of still went ahead and did this channel. I had a program about the arts on it. And it was sort of done, and we did it in this linear way, as though people still would, you know, sort of tune in at 7 on a Thursday, you know what I mean? And of course, it comes to the point where you think, actually, there's no need for any of that. And of course, that's the great beauty. This interview, when it goes out, will go out and you can watch it whenever you like. But anyway, that was the state of play in 2006, 7 or whatever. And so look at us now. I mean, you know, there's huge numbers of, you know, channels and yourself and people like Trigonometry Guys, you know, and Unheard. And NCF, of course. So yes, I'm very pleased. It's still got to get bigger. Oh, and also the other most important thing, GB News. I mean, you wouldn't have thought 5 years ago that we'd have had GB News or even Talk TV, which is kind of, it's not sort of so overt in its kind of mission statement, but it's basically better than Sky. But GB News has been they've managed to make a real success of it, if not financially, and that's not their fault, you know. So I think it is, without question, better, because I think that the big problem for people like me, who feel, you know, have my views, is that the mainstream broadcast media is one of the biggest problems of the lot. You asked me about it earlier. Newspapers, you can actually still go to The Guardian or to The Telegraph, or you can still sort of see the difference. But really, when it comes to ITV, Woke Central, BBC, Woke Central, Channel 4, and Channel 5, all of them, and their news channels, very much all from the same hymn sheet. I'd say, you know, very much the kind of deliverers of the message. Yes, I think it's more power to our elbow. I mean, we need some big investors, I think, all of us.
Peter Whittle, thank you for joining us.
Oh, it's been an absolute pleasure, Liv. Thank you very, very much. Thank you. Thanks.